Welcome to the Public Morality. Since the Bill of Rights was ratified, there has been a commitment to a free press, a concept that runs a parallel course with a free society. But with public trust declining and increasing an amorphous definition of the press, what does it mean to be a journalist along with the added complexities of the 21st century? Journalism is no longer just collecting, writing, and publishing articles in newspapers and magazines or broadcasting them on the radio. What it means to be a journalist of the 21st century has taken on an entire new meaning. This is a topic that we've explored before in the Public Morality. Think of it as an ongoing series because it is impossible to have a public morality if the institution committed to holding its elected officials accountable are not trusted. Joining me today is Professor Benjamin Davis. Professor Davis is an assistant professor at Cal State Northridge in California. Professor Benjamin Davis, welcome to the Public Morality.
Glad to be here, Byron. Thank you.
I want to begin by asking you, in a 21st century context, what is journalism in your view?
Well, traditionally, at least contemporarily, it's been defined by many as comforting the afflicted and to afflict the comforted. And I've never taken that approach. I think the role of the journalist is, and journalism is fairly simple, and I write about it. It is to, you seek the truth, you attain the truth, you reveal the truth. It's just that simple. That's what we are supposed to do. In the process of doing that, we may be finding out truths about governments, about neighbors, about police departments, many things. But the point is, it says find out what the truth is for any particular topic, for any particular group, and you just report it, the chips fall where they may.
Now, would you hold that same definition for what I'm calling an amorphous term known as media?
Only if it has what would be First Amendment protections media. Those types of media, if they have First Amendment protections, they still have the responsibilities of getting to the truth and telling the truth in a very responsible way. If they don't, then they lose their First Amendment protections, in which case they can easily be sued. They could be run out of business. That has happened before. But yes, media in general, if it has a First Amendment protection, well, then I believe that their role should also be involved with getting the truth out to the public.
So with that said, does that in any way distinguish from what's now being called new media?
Well, new media is a term that I think is technology driven. And it's once we move to the digital realm of media, there were just so many different ways of approaching getting information distributed to the public that the term new media came along. And no matter what it is, whether it's new media or old media, at the end of the day, it still has to have that old analog type of protection, which protects you in the digital world of, are you telling the truth? Do you have a constitutional protection? I mean, you could be using new media, you can be doing streaming, be doing smartphone reporting, you could be doing social media, all new different ways of getting information out to the public. At the end of the day, that information has to be reliable in order to maintain its constitutional protection. So you can call it new media. It is called new media in some respects, but the basic role of the journalist within that never changes. For instance, the technology progresses, the basic tenets of journalism remain the same.
With that said, there is a difference in my view between, say, Lester Holt of NBC Nightly News, mm-hmm. and say Fox News's Sean Hannity. Both are held under the same media umbrella. Is that okay, or should we be more discerning? Is there a way for us to be more discerning?
Actually, that's perfectly okay that they both are under the same umbrella. I mean, as you know, the umbrella of journalism is huge. I mean, you have, for instance, you have sports journalism, which has First Amendment protections, business journalism. You could have neighbors reporting on neighbors if they have their own little media company, a media website or blog for their neighborhood, they're reporting on each other, they still have the same constitutional protections as Hannity and as Lester Holt. The reason being is the Supreme Court has ruled throughout the years that you need this marketplace of ideas out there in the media in order to maintain a robust and strong democracy. So it goes about protecting everyone. And even people like Hannity and even Lester Holt and the neighbor, they can report information that is inaccurate as long as it isn't done with malice and forethought and reckless disregard for the truth that actually exists. So this umbrella of journalism protects many different types of communication as long as they remain responsible and protected under the Constitution. There's a ruling that called New York Times versus Sullivan, which I'm sure you're familiar with. It sort of came to light just recently with the Johnny Depp case. And you have to show a certain amount of responsibility when it comes to putting out information to the public. And the jury basically said that Johnny Depp's former wife was not responsible. She operated recklessly. And when you operate recklessly and with forethought, with malice, well, then you don't have your constitutional protection. So everyone basically fall under this umbrella of journalism, whether they be Hannity or Lester Holt. But there are different types of journalism. They all fall under the constitutional protection of journalism, the First Amendment.
And as you well know, you've alluded to it on several occasions already, that the First Amendment protects the freedom of the press. The press has always been seen as a vital safeguard for the preservation of democracy. But the world of 1791, when the Bill of Rights were ratified, was not the world of 1865, let alone 2022. But it seems to me we've maintained a notion of the press in our collective minds without considering its relationship to a changing world. How do you see that, sir?
Well, let's see. Let's take the example of Ben Franklin, who was probably, if you will, the country's earliest blogger, albeit an analog newspaper. He was a blogger, if you will. And he and his brother decided to take on the governments of Massachusetts and the other colonies that had opinions and policies that they didn't like. They took them on in a very controversial way. And I don't see that any different than what's happening today. And, you know, I point out that the group NWA, the original rap group, one of the original rap groups, they express complaints against the police, similar to what Ben Franklin and his brother, the complaints they had against the government of Massachusetts. The expression, freedom of expression, writing those expressions down and distributing them to the public, that really doesn't change regardless of the technology. And if there's anything that's prescient about the Supreme Court's interpretations and the constitutional writers, somehow they figured out that there's a permanence to free speech protections that's sort of technology proof. And that's where we stand. I don't think that much has changed. When you want to protest the government, or you want to complain about the government, or you find the government somehow involved in nefarious activities, that can be reported on today, just as it was during the colonial period with the Franklin brothers.
You know, I'm so glad you mentioned Ben Franklin, because, you know, we tend to look at one time in our history, there was this sort of pervasive moment where journalism was, to use a Fox News term, fair and balanced. But you have Ben Franklin's publications. I would add Thomas Paine's publications.
Yeah.
Then you get into the yellow journalism of William Randolph Hearst. And yeah, I would even throw in there to even sort of a benign bias of news publications who were either unable or unwilling to see those who had been traditionally marginalized. So is this where we are right now merely a continuation of an old phenomenon that's really as old, even older than the Republic itself?
Yes, I think it is a continuation. We can get infatuated by the technology and the ways of getting that information out. But at the end of the day, you're going to hurt someone with false information, or you're going to help the public with accurate information, regardless of the technology. And yellow journalism exists today. Fake news exists today. And the technology somehow can mask fake news. It's difficult for users to find out what is true and what is not true. But if it comes down to the courts, it can be discovered, and it eventually will be discovered if something is fake and not true. I believe that's one reason why you have companies like Facebook putting a lot of effort into discovering fake information that's put on their platforms, because they know that eventually the law will catch up with them one way or the other. They can't always claim that we're just a distribution source. They are more than a distribution source to some extent, as massive as they are. They have to take a greater responsibility than just being a simple pipeline.
I think it was, 1919 is when Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes famously opined that free speech does not protect falsely yelling fire in a crowded theater.
Right.
We have a number of platforms today that are viewed as media, falsely yelling fire, seemingly almost on a daily basis. Can anything be done to address this, or is it too late?
It is, in some respects, it's too late. Journalism and society is in the process of catching up with the technology. And the technology companies are in the process of catching up with their own technology. It's sort of like I don't want to say it's a Dr. Frankenstein they've created, but they have created a technology that is roaming along on its own, and the rest of society is trying to catch up with it. Whether it be the fake ads that go out during the campaign season online, or what you see on TV, what you see on screen as opposed to on TV, because a lot of the information comes out on screens now. It's not too late. It isn't too late. I believe court decisions will have to catch up with much of the fake news distribution and the fake news origination. I think that we're in a transition in terms of how you monitor information that's coming out and how you catch up with what is real and what is not real. It's all technology, all because of a fast-growing technology. The Moore principle, that technology roughly will change every 18 months. That's what he said originally back in, I believe it was 65. But now the technology marches along much, much faster than that.
Professor Davis, we just made you here on the Public Morality King for a day. And so how
king,
might we-
King for a day?
You're king for a day. Well, at least until this broadcast concludes. How might we view such platforms like you just referenced, Facebook, Twitter, and then you got Politico, and then the publication that you and I have both written for, Huffington Post, HuffPost now. How should we view those in light of what you just said?
Well, I think that's how they should view themselves. If they are going to distribute information to the public, they have a responsibility to make sure that what they are putting out there has some element of truth. Otherwise, I believe that they should be prepared to be exposed to the court system. It's really, as you know, that people tend to forget that the democracy that we say we love so much depends dearly on accurate information going out through the press, through the media. And anyone that strays from that, that has a huge, massive pipeline, they are a danger to democracy. And not just in the US or around the world, as Facebook has discovered, people can become reckless around the world using their platform, and governments have fallen as a result. People have died as a result. But this particular democracy in the U.S. Relies a lot on accurate information and a robust journalism. The HuffPost and Politico and Facebook and Hannity and Drudge, they can say whatever they want as long as it doesn't become malice and with reckless and irresponsible. I can't emphasize enough that no matter who you are, and believe me, it's pretty soon we'll find people in neighborhoods that are putting out their own publications for their neighbors. Those very people still have the same responsibilities as the HuffPost, and the New York Times. This is all about expressions that must be healthy to the public discourse. And when they are not healthy, well, mechanisms have to be remedied. And that will be the court system. Once the courts catch up with the technology, it's happening so fast right now. But I don't see any distinctions, just like I don't see any distinctions between what Ben Franklin was doing and NWA when they said "fuck the police." And I don't see distinctions between what Drudge does and what the New York Times does when it comes to protections. And some people, they're old school journalists, and they sort of get on my nerves, trust me, that think that there's this hierarchy within journalism, whereas there's elite journalism, there's Dan Rather, and there's Walter Cronkite, and then there are guys like Drudge, and there are people around the corner that have started their own podcast. So it's different groups altogether. No different at all when it comes to journalism. They fall under that journalism protection, under that journalism umbrella, because each of them have that First Amendment protection if they're saying something that you don't like. And like I said before, even if they say something that isn't accurate, they still have that First Amendment protection as long as that inaccuracy comes with certain caveats, that it wasn't malice and it wasn't reckless, purposefully.
Well, if journalism, at least theoretically, is that bridge, I'm sort of paraphrasing your words here, as you said earlier, is a bridge between what happens and what the people should do with that information, what's the danger to democracy when the practice of journalism has altered over time, as you have alluded, while sort of maintaining a stilted definition and has not caught up with technology?
Well, there is a danger of advocacy journalism. And there's also the promise and the benefit of advocacy journalism, both of which still fall under that journalism umbrella, First Amendment protection. But there's not much we can do about that. We actually want that marketplace, the marketplace of ideas, to be out there. At some point, the citizenry has to figure out what their responsibility is in terms of the information that they intake. They are overwhelmed right now, especially the younger generation. They're overwhelmed with information coming at them, and they don't know what to believe. They may find one little nugget of a trusted source that they want to stick with, but what if that trusted source turns out to be putting out fake news, which has happened on more than one occasion? Advocacy journalism has always been around. It will be around, and it's just something that has to be accepted. Now, I don't think that it's good for what's the mainstream journalism organization to consistently be involved in advocacy journalism, because you could lose the public's trust. Advocacy journalism does always involve the possibility that you could lose people who pay to use your site, who pay for your paper or for your television or for your cable. You could lose people based upon customers based upon that, your advocacy, but it's a natural part of the democracy. It's the fake news part of it. You could advocate something and still be accurate. You could advocate something that is not real. That is the real danger to democracy.
So when you say advocacy journalism, are you talking about opinion formats?
Yes. Or let's say I've had more than a few students who decided to create their blog journals on environmental issues, and they clearly want to advocate a cleaner environment through their journalism. And that's their conscious choice. They pursue it hard. And that can be considered journalism and good journalism, but it has to be accurate. It's one-sided, but it still has to be accurate. There's have to be fair and balanced. Well, of course, I teach them to put balance in there. But once they leave my classroom and they continue their blogs, I tell you that 90% of them, probably more than that, stay on one side of the issue, which is the side that they prefer. Hopefully they remain accurate with the information that they're putting out to the public. One way to prove your accuracy is to put in opposing opinions. That's how you balance it out. It may not always seem fair, but if you try to balance it out, show the possibility that you're being objective, because you can never be completely objective. That helps advocacy journalism. Advocacy journalism, to some extent, has to show the other side of the issue in order to mirror what they want to get out to the public accurately. In other words, you can always say that there are issues, there are problems that we want to expose. Well, in order to do that, you have to show the source of the problem. And usually that source is not something that you advocate for, something that you believe in, but you have to show it in order to expose or in order to report on what you believe really should be known. You just can't tell the public, these are the facts, this is the law, this is what I believe is should be done, and leave it at that. It is, this is the law, these are the facts, this is why things should be done because of. What is the because of? Show the public what the because of is. In the process of doing that, you're showing a little bit of objectivity.
You know, when I listen to that last answer, now I'm thinking, and I'll just pick on two stations in particular, MSNBC and Fox News. Mm-hmm. They'll have an issue, and they'll have someone noted on their side, the side that they lean toward philosophically. And then as an attempt to be fair and balanced, they'll have the opposing side will be a blind orangutan with stage 3 cancer and Alzheimer's disease, and they'll try to make you think like this is fair and balanced. So can we avoid that? Or that's just a practice?
That's strictly business. And I worked at both of those places, by the way.
I know you did. That's why I picked them.
that's strictly business. That's all about ratings and making money for corporations and shareholders. Fox does what it does because they have an average age demographic of 63 and up male, and they like that type of stuff. And as long as it's making money for them, they're going to keep doing it. And in order to do their promotions to the public in general, to say fair and balanced news, well, they're going to pull in someone that will say something that's slightly opposed to what their brand is. They don't do that quite as often as they used to. They used to have like their regular foil, the liberal foil that they would bring in. But that's all about business. It's all about making money. And MSNBC, they don't do it as much. They're just pretty much saying, look, we're opposed to something and we're going to state reasons why. You have anchors like Rachel Maddow, who takes a real teach-in approach to her journalism, which is usually fact-based. And you can say that, everyone can adjust facts to their own benefit. But I watch her, and her facts usually stand, the test of scrutiny. You do have bias, but they know that that is what's making them money. And when Fox News audience dies out, and they have to look around and figure out, well, what's the next demographic we can go for? Well, they're going to cater to that demographic. They care. I believe they do not care about the First Amendment at all. I don't believe they care about the Constitution at all, except for where the Constitution gives them the rights as a corporation to have certain rights of their own. I think at the end of the day, when we see patterns, when we see styles and brands on cable news, it all has to do with shareholders and shareholders wanting profits.
On that note, I'll throw out a name that you and I are both familiar with. I remember, and this sort of goes back to the burden also of the consumer being discerning. Chris Matthews did a segment on the fact that Exxon paid no taxes. There was another corporation that paid no taxes that particular year, which was General Electric. General Electric happens to be owned by owns NBC. So the fact that General Electric paid no taxes, somehow they were omitted from the story. And I don't want to rehash that story per se, but there still remains, I happen to know that information at the time, but there still remains a burden on the consumer to be active and discerning and not just take it whole cloth.
Yeah, well, think about how Chris Matthews' viewers, his fans were. I mean, they practically held him on a pedestal. And whatever he said was pretty much, you know, religion. And for that reason, he had the responsibility to take out three seconds, to say this show or NBC is owned by General Electric, which also did not pay taxes last year, and then carry on.
That wasn't even 3 seconds, by the way. Go ahead.
Right. And I mean, that's his responsibility as a journalist. As a corporation, it's their responsibility. Because the more integrity you have with your audience, the more likely they're going to keep coming back. And once they start to not believe you, they'll think twice about coming back. They don't want to get burned at the picnic table again, because you put out information that was absolutely wrong. I made you look like the crazy uncle in the attic. But when you can put out accurate information, whether it be quickly or over, you know, prolonged period of time, like Rachel Maddow does, well, then that helps the consumer. It gives them muscle. It gives them picnic table muscle. They can say things that are accurate, and they can, to some extent, defend it. But when you're giving them bad information or partial information, and they end up looking like fools in front of relatives and friends and classmates, well, they're not likely to come back to you, especially when that information comes out in the public in general, and then they realize that they weren't given what? I didn't realize that General Electric didn't pay any taxes at all. But my man, Chris Matthews, went on about Exxon. Why didn't he say anything? Well, you know, that's the type of credit integrity that reporters can't afford to lose.
You mentioned the information overload created in large extent by social media lessens the appreciation, in my view, for the traditional journalism that you talked about earlier, and that it fosters the belief that we the people can simply just find our preconceived truth anywhere we want to and not be challenged by those facts that you just referred to that are critical to a democracy.
Yeah. Oh, that's fun, isn't it? That's great. I mean, it's nice. Everyone can find their own little cozy corner in terms of information that makes them feel good and reinforces their beliefs, whether their beliefs are attached to something accurate or not. You know, I don't, you know, I have my Facebook group and unfortunately my daughter, she never sees anything I post. She said, Dad, I check in there every 10 business days just to see what's going on, and I'm out of there because it's not for them. But, you know, I have my Facebook friends. I know for sure that I have evangelical, Southern evangelical Christians. I know that I have very liberal Christians, conservative Jews, and liberal Jews, progressive Jews. I have people that don't believe in anything. I have the entire mix in there because I don't want anyone to think that they're comfortable enough in my Facebook space to think that they're not going to be challenged in terms of their thinking and their assumptions about life. But most people don't always do that. They want the comfort of the echo chamber, people reinforcing what they already think the truth to be. That is a danger to society. That because people can walk around like blind mice, for the most part, and thinking things that are totally not true. I can say that once the former president, the recent former president, reinforced what he called fake news, well, it gave everyone a license to declare anything that they didn't like to be fake news. And thus, in many cases, people became blinded to the truth. And to some extent, people are suffering behind that. Even some of his own allies who are in court right now, are in jail right now because of the January 6th insurrection that they were behind, which was driven by fake news, which was advocated by him in many respects. So I, you know, this echo chamber that social media provides is it's a challenge to society. I don't know what the answer is. No one knows what the answer is, other than people have to figure out what is their responsibility to self and society and somehow tie the two together.
In the spirit of being fair and balanced and full disclosure, I would also add to your list of Facebook friends the host of the Public Morality, so everybody knows. Yes, sir. According to a October 2021 Gallup poll, that only 36% that were polled had a great deal or fair amount of trust in mass media. Though the term mass media was not specifically defined, if only 36% trust the enterprise whose primary mission is government accountability, how can it fulfill its the original mission of being the fourth estate?
Well, you know, I'm going to be skeptical, which I'm supposed to be as a journalist. And so any poll that comes out, I'm going to be skeptical of it, period. That 36% number doesn't particularly bother me. It sounds familiar. The 38, 36, 35, 33 number is pretty much a third that is always in opposition to something one way or the other. I mean, when you drop below, when you get into the 20s, well, then there's something really critical there. But I think at any point you can find a third of the population that's going to be opposed to just about anything that you do, unless you're a purely populist president or purely populist issue and everybody loves it, like gas prices going down by $5 a gallon or something like that. That doesn't bother me. I remember being at NPR when it used to be called National Public Radio, and we weren't popular with plenty of conservatives on Capitol Hill, and we weren't popular with some left liberals in San Francisco, other parts of the country. We got it from all sides, and that was a badge of honor. What matters is whether you like us or not, are we telling you the truth? So if you're part of the 36% that has a low opinion of the news media, is it because, or mass media, is it because we're giving you information that you don't like to hear, or is it because we're giving you information that is wrong? And people have to understand that they have to ask themselves a question, I don't like what they're telling me, but is it wrong? If it's wrong, well, then I think it's okay for that 36% not to like them. But if it's because you just don't like it, because you don't agree with it, well, that's our job. I mean, we're not supposed to be liked. And I tell my students that all the time. Be prepared. Someone's going to spit in front of you. Someone's going to spit on you. You know, if you're doing your job right, someone's going to complain. But your only protection is the truth. So I can handle the low numbers. No problem whatsoever, as long as there's accurate information behind behind those numbers.
You mentioned NPR, and I think it was Newt Gingrich who really did the campaign toward defunding NPR, saying that it was the equivalent of Fox News. It was the less version of Fox News. And I had a lot of people accept that whole cloth. that, well, why are we funding the liberal press when we wouldn't fund a conservative press? Doesn't that go back to just believing what we want to believe and not really understanding the ramifications of between the two? Because they're not, in my view, they're not similar.
Newt just used NPR or National Public Radio as a dog whistle. It was just a foil. He knew darn well that he couldn't eliminate it, but it was a great thing to advocate against, that's for sure, was that liberal media. But you know, he depends on that to some extent. Most conservative politicians depend on their local NPR stations to some extent. So they're not going to go too far against it. But you can still say that, hey, they are the villain of the month or the election cycle. You can use them for that reason. But it's part and parcel with being part of what National Public Radio was when I worked there, and NPR now, though NPR now tends to be a little bit more on the we're going to look over our shoulder side before we do this. But it's still public media, and the public needs it. I mean, if we didn't have public broadcasting, well, then everything would look like Hannity, Drudge, Maddow, and Chris Hayes. But you know, you need something that has explicitly a responsibility to the public, and it doesn't always make that. You know, it doesn't always get over the hurdle of being totally responsible to the public, but they do have the responsibility to reflect, to take criticism, and to go back and try again. Their shareholders, public. Hannity's shareholders, different story altogether. So it's public radio, public broadcasting. At the end of the day, they're going to make mistakes, but they have to remember that they have to go back and reflect and try to get it right a second time around. Hannity doesn't have to do that. As long as he's making money, he's cool.
But in the broader sense, though, how can democracy survive if the only source I trust is ProfessorBenjaminADavis.com? That's the only source I trust. That's probably a good source, but it's the only one I trust. Can democracy, I see you agree with that. Can democracy survive if that's a persistent mindset across the board?
You know what? We don't know yet. We have no idea. I'm very bullish on journalism and its future. But we don't know the answer to your question yet. We still have to go through a few more generations of technology and citizen awareness and citizen responsibility before we know if democracy will survive the onslaught of information that is just a huge spigot of information flowing out at people. No one knows the answer to that. Everyone's hoping. But no one knows.
There also seems, in my view, with the advancement of technology in the 21st century, to be a journalistic hybrid that's been created. It's individuals that want the journalism title without the ethical responsibilities associated with the profession. How do you see that?
I think that you should let them do it. Some of them will go through the trouble of learning the role of journalists and the legal protections that journalism has, and others won't. They'll just be totally irresponsible. They'll say whatever they want, and if it catches up with them, it's going to hurt them. It's going to cost them. But I'm all in favor of that. I'm all in favor of the group of teenagers starting their own news station, which is very possible technology-wise, and they can compete with the local TV stations. Let's say you could have a group of teenagers that decide they're only going to do all the high school sports in their particular region, in their city, and in the process of doing that, they may get information wrong. They probably would. They may say something that hurts someone, something that's inaccurate, something that's they can be sued for. All of that can happen. All of that should happen. And it will happen because the technology already says that what I just described is going to happen. And to, it's happening now to a small extent, but there will be neighborhood outlets that are out there putting out information. And you can't stop them. You can't stop them because they're not the New York Times. The technology is already saying that there are, the technology tells them that you can't stop them. But freedom of expression, freedom of press also says that you cannot stop them. We just have to hope, want, encourage smaller outlets, the freelance reporter, the person that's instantly a journalist, to understand the importance of the truth and their role within the Constitution. I mean, this is, I mean, you think about plumbers, you think about lawyers and ministers, and there's only one profession that's mentioned for protection in the Constitution, and that's the press. That's how important it is to society. And when people, I think people need to think about that when they decide, oh, I'm going to be a journalist for a day. Well, why is it that this particular field was protected when this country started? And when you absorb that, you start to realize you have a little responsibility, even if you're only doing high school scores for your neighborhood. More people need to understand that if they want to step into this field, it's more than just being on TV, more than just doing the red carpet, and more than just doing interesting feature stories. You're stepping into a field that has constitutional protection from more than 200 years ago for a very important reason. It's one of the pillars of a democracy.
Technology, as you have alluded, has created more in 21st century citizen journalists. Could we conclude from your last response that paradoxically the democratization of technology, in that it has created citizen journalists, but it has made the nation less democratic, in that it's also aided an undermining of traditional journalism in the sense that the standards have lowered for traditional journalism as you have this influx of citizen journalism through the democratization of technology?
Yep, yep. Certain standards have lowered, and I think it's going to get lower to some extent. I think eventually they will. When people get in a corner for information, when there's a crisis for information, well, they're going to. That's when they're going to understand the importance of good journalism, the importance of stepping outside of their echo chamber to find out what is really going on. But yeah, I think standards are lower as more freelancers get in and declare themselves journalists. There will be issues. I see it in the classroom all the time, but I'm there to catch them. I'm thinking sometimes, oh boy, if I wasn't here and they put that out, oh my goodness. But it's going to be happening over and over multiple times. And it's not just going to be human beings doing this. I mean, we have to be aware that there are software programs that are creating information that can be considered that people would think of as journalists. And I'm speaking of artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence has a way of teaching itself. And the more it learns, the more it decides to make decisions about reporting that a certain ethnicity creates certain issues within society. Those type of things can happen only because it has data that says these things happen, but it doesn't have the reason. It doesn't have the common sense that a human would have. That's going to influence how journalism looks to a great degree. We have no idea where artificial intelligence is going to end up in terms of its influence on journalism. But we do know for sure that there needs to be a human factor involved with artificial intelligence to keep it from running out of control and running roughshod over accuracy and over truths and things that only humans can discern. I think the individual the private journalism, the blogs, that's going to continue to grow. And that is a very, very good thing for democracy. But we need those bloggers to understand that the role of journalism is all about truth. And even if you don't like the truth, that's your job. It's okay to advocate, but you have to be clear in terms of what you're advocating against. Don't just tell me what you're advocating against. Show me what you're advocating against. And then I can say, oh, okay. All of my students, they have to do a blog, and their goal is to be objective as much as possible and give both sides of the story within their, you know, their news stories. But just in case, and it's part of the digital media pyramid that I designed for news, just in case, at the bottom of each story, there's something called educate yourself. And the students have to put information in there that they may not agree with, but it's always the other side. It's the opposite of what their story is about. They can put something in there that sort of supports pretty much what the story is about. They have to put something in that is neutral, but they always have to put something in that is opposite of what their story is, what the theme of their story is, and to let people educate themselves. And a lot of it has to do, the future of journalism has to do with the audience educating themselves about information and not just accepting things whole cloth.
I'm going to come back to something you said about artificial intelligence, because I think there's an assumption that artificial intelligence is neutral. And what I heard in your statement is that it has its own set of biases.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. Yeah. It's garbage in, garbage out. Now, who's putting the information into the artificial intelligence platforms? I mean, we've already seen some examples of that already. In terms of information being put into artificial intelligence that scans for criminals. We've seen people arrested because AI platforms have said that this particular person of a certain hue was the same as another person who was a criminal. Those type of things will happen. It's artificial intelligence is... It's based upon machine learning, and it's interesting. I don't want to get into too much detail, but the more data that we put out on the internet as individuals, the more intelligent artificial intelligence gets. It just grabs all that information and it starts making decisions based upon that. It will start making decisions on its own. And at some point, there's reason. I mean, there is... Someone has to be able to use subjectivity with data. Artificial intelligence cannot do that. Someone has to say that just because you're saying that all of this data indicates a certain result, someone has to say, well, that result has certain caveats that you, artificial intelligence, and the data doesn't know. And at this point, everyone understands that there has to be a human at the button end, someone at the enter side of artificial intelligence that finally says, okay, go ahead and enter and go. And you can control to an extent what our artificial intelligence or AI puts out to the public. But we're not quite at that point yet. AI can pretty much, you know, it can grow, and it can pretty much take over and distribute as much information in any way that it wants to. It's capable of doing that. If it's stopped, it's usually because there are humans, there are corporations that are putting holds and pauses on the progress of artificial intelligence. But we don't know where it will stop. No one knows where artificial intelligence will stop if you leave it unfettered.
I want to end our conversation with a little thought experiment, have a little fun. It's 2022. Would there, in your view, be a Woodward and Bernstein in this 2022 climate of the press?
Oh yeah. But you know what? They won't be working for the Washington Post. Well, they will be. They may be working for the Washington Post, but they will be. They will be people that have access to databases and they will pull out information, and they will be responsible. They will understand the role of journalists. They will have to, they will know that whatever they put out to the public has to be accurate, and they will put it out. They will find, yeah, they will find corruption. There are people that will be finding corruption. It's in, we'll get back to artificial intelligence. AI is going to make it easier for the person in the basement to get data, to get information, and redistribute it to the public. Researching will be much, much easier for individuals. You'll be able to use your smartphone. Let's not say in 2022, but you'll be able to use your smartphone to gather reams of information that will help you investigate governments and local school boards and you know, military organizations. I think in the near future, we will find a slew of Woodward and Bernsteins coming out with information, and the public's gonna have a hard time keeping up with it. And it will put the government on guard. It will put government leaders on guard, and they'll probably start thinking, well, maybe I don't wanna go into politics because if I'm dirty, or if I become dirty, I'm going to get caught. And you will get caught. I'm very optimistic about journalism in that respect, but we need our people to be responsible. The tools for doing Woodward and Bernstein type of work will be there in spades, but the type of thinking, the responsibility that comes with being a journalist, we need to make sure that that's accompanied with anyone that's using this, the technologies that are gonna be there in front of them. I'm super, super, super optimistic about what journalism will be doing to help the public find corruption in the near future.
Professor Benjamin A. Davis, I want to thank you, sir, for joining me today on the Public Around. I much appreciated your wise counsel, sir.
Well, I was glad to be here. I hope I offered something that your audience can certainly use, and it's good talking with you.
The Public Morality welcomes your comments. You can contact me at byron@publicmorality.org. That's Byron, BYRON, @publicmorality.org. You can follow me on Facebook as well as Twitter. The archive broadcast can be found on iTunes, Spotify, Amazon Prime, and SoundCloud. Those listening to the Public Morality on WSNC can now listen on its app. Using your mobile device, simply go to your application page, search WSNC 90.5, and click open to listen from anywhere. And once again, I want to thank Elvin Jenkins and Michael Burns at WGAB in Huntsville, Alabama, for allowing us to broadcast the Public Morality at their studios. The Public Morality is produced at WSNC on the campus of Winston-Salem State University. For all of us at the Public Morality, I'm Byron Williams.